Yes, well, thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for coming out on a wet and rainy night. I appreciate it very much. Let's see. It's really a personal pleasure for me to get to tell you a little bit about this Grow Your 100 exhibition that has just opened, as Jennifer said, last week in New York. It's been a wonderful project that John and I have worked on together for 5 years, and it's really great to get to share it with you. We had a jam-packed opening last week in New York, and I want to tell you a little bit about that experience, and in particular, take you through the exhibition. And I want to do that by telling you a story. That seems appropriate in terms of children's books. So let me set the stage, if I may, for this story. Picture, if you will, it's December 9th, last week. It's New York City. It's dark outside. The evening traffic noise in Manhattan is still loud enough that I can hear it filtering in from the street. I'm standing inside the exhibition hall at the Grolier Club, which looks like this right now, as the curator of the club's current exhibition, 100 Books Famous in Children's Literature. I'm doing my final check before the show opens to the public in the morning. It's actually really a wonderful moment to get to do that quiet check. The exhibition has been 5 years in the making, and truly, it seemed like a minor miracle to me that those wonderful books and their companion toys and games are finally here. And I see Bruce Crawford smiling back there. Bruce has been on this journey as well, and it was really fun to have him there last week to watch. The 100 books in front of me in the Grolier Exhibition Hall represent 400 years of famous children's literature in the Western world, all published between 1600 and the year 2000. Most importantly, though, these books are time-honored favorites of children through age 12. That was our definition of a child. They're borrowed from 22 generous lenders, some of them the finest literary institutions and private collections in North America. I'm thinking, as I'm standing in front of this hall, how my advisory team and I worked, actually we worked fairly diligently to arrive at our definition of famous, which is the backbone concept of the Grow Your 100 canon, if you will. We defined famous as those children's books that were widely known at the time of their creation and admired over following generations, in the process demonstrating literary merit and unparalleled popularity. So that's the basis upon which we selected these books. I remember once we finalized this definition, the book selection process then took another 2 full years before it was complete. My team and I, we were surprised at how challenging it was to select only 100 books over a 400-year period of time. You can appreciate that that was a challenge. We had lots of spirited discussions, but we were very congenial groups, so it was quite fun. We were also very excited and engaged in the process. It was a really wonderful experience. And I want to tell you at the end, someone remind me, please, I want to tell you relative to this selection process a story about Mary Poppins and Pippi Longstocking. So, Maggie, help me remember at the end, okay? many of the books that we ultimately selected are timeless classics of children's literature. Many of them are not well known, if remembered at all today, and that was purposeful, something that we thought was important to bring forward, both books that we know and love and books that we did know and love and no longer do. The books were selected primarily as first editions. Their physical condition was less important than their provenance. And so you'll see some of the books that I'll show you are beautiful in their physical manifestation. Some of them are very loved, as children's books often are. So, as I walk from the entrance to the exhibition hall over to this introduction case, I can see this circle of books that highlights a different theme in the exhibition. There are actually 11 themes in the show, and I'm going to talk briefly tonight about 7 of those. I'm going to talk about fairy tales, books of learning, nursery rhymes, poetry, books for girls and boys, animals, and fantasy. So I'll take you through these various cases. So I'll ask you now to walk with me as I make my final round of some of the display cases in the exhibition hall. So I come first to our case on fairy tales. One of the most popular forms of children's literature, fairy tales are stories involving fantastic beings and forces, like fairies, wizards, goblins, witches. Often they lead to a happy ending. In this fairy tale case, I see a variety of wonderful books. And the first that I see is Charles Perrault's Histories or Times of Past, pardon me, Histories or Tales of Times Past, published in 1729 on loan from the Houghton Library at Harvard. Perrault's famous book, originally written in French, contains 7 of the most iconic fairy tales that we know from Western European history. And these ones that we still read today are Little Red Riding Hood, Puss in Boots, Cinderella, and Sleeping Beauty. Significantly, the frontispiece of this book shows an old woman telling stories to a group of children by the fireside. You can see from the engraved emblem in the illustration, this is an early reference to the monumental character of Mother Goose, who was later, interestingly, more associated with nursery rhymes than with fairy tales, where she began. In this fairy tale case that I'm standing in front of in my mind, there are also folk tales, fables, and legends. Examples of these 3 important genres, they're all related to fairy tales in some way. They include the following. The folk tale, German popular stories. This is the English translation published in 1827 of the folk tales collected by the Grimm brothers, first written in 1812 and published in German as Kinder und Hausmarken. We most often refer to this book, we all know it, as Grimm's Fairy Tales. It's odd that we refer to it that way because it's actually not a group of fairy tales, it's a group of folk tales collected from oral tradition. It represents the classic folk stories of things like Hansel and Gretel, Rapunzel, Rumpelstiltskin, and many of the treasures that we love to read with our children today. This particular English translation is illustrated by George Cruikshank. It's on loan from the Coates and Children's Library at Princeton. There are fables in this case that I'm standing in front of. Fables are stories that are intended to emphasize a useful truth. They often involve animals that speak or act like humans. Here we have the fables of Aesop's. This version interpreted by Samuel Croxall, illustrated by Elisha Kirkle, and published in 1722. Aesop's fables were among the earliest in Western tradition in terms of fables, sometimes attributed to a storyteller in ancient Greece, although we don't really know the actual origin of Aesop's fairy tales. They include such tales as the tortoise and the hare, the town mouse and the country mouse, the ant and the grasshopper, and the goose that laid the golden egg. They've been interpreted countless times over the centuries, often by important authors or important illustrators. This volume, created for readers of all ages, quickly became a favorite of children after its publication because of its many engraved illustrations. It's on loan from a private collector. In this case is also a legend. This is the legend of the Merry Adventures of Robin Hood, written and illustrated by Howard Pyle in 1883. Robin Hood is one of the best-known legends in the Western world. It tells the story of a mythic figure that in real life was possibly a low-born highwayman or potentially a dispossessed nobleman seeking justice by stealing from the rich to give to the poor. This is the version of the story compiled and illustrated by the famous artist and Brandywine School founder Howard Pyle that brings together the key elements of the Robin Hood legend as we know it today. That's part of why this book is so important and so famous. It's on loan from the UCLA Library Special Collections. As I approach the case containing books of faith and learning, I remember that it spans nearly 400 years in time. There are volumes in this case from as early as the mid-17th century to the late 20th century. Included here, I see the important books of learning for children, such as Orbis Pictus. This is an amazing book. It was written by Johann Comenius in 1658. This is the earliest book in this exhibition. It's very, very early as a book for children. It's one that basically no one recognizes today, but for over two centuries, it was the most read school book throughout all of Europe, translated into many languages to help children learn Latin in their native tongue. It's a simple illustrated encyclopedia. It contains keyed pictures, descriptive columns of bilingual text. This one happens to be first edition, so it's German and Latin. It provided an innovative way to teach linguistics, as well as the fundamentals of the natural world to children. In many ways, for me, this book is the foundation. It's the touchstone of this exhibition. It's an incredibly important book. It's also one of the earliest efforts at integrating text and illustration, so it makes it a very pivotal beginning step in the picture book for children. Some people call this the first picture book for children. That's something you could dispute, but it is certainly one of the very earliest, so very, very important in the history of children's literature. The copy you see here was published a year later in 1659 in English and in Latin, and it's on loan from our fellow book club member, Ellen Michelson. And here you see a book that makes us all smile. Me too. This is the Dick and Jane Basic Pre-Primer. It's written by William Elson and William Gray in 1936. It's most often referred to as the Dick and Jane Reader. Most of us know this book very well. As a matter of fact, in the middle decades of the 20th century, this book was so popular in the United States that it's probably what most of us in this room learned to read with, or perhaps our children did. Very famous book. After unprecedented use throughout American schools during the 20th century, this book gradually fell out of favor due to its portrayal of predominantly Caucasian, able-bodied suburban children. I'm sorry to say. But its impact is absolutely undeniable on the learning for children. This copy is on loan from the Osborne Collection of Early Children's Books at the Toronto Public Library. And here we have one of my favorite books, The Cat in the Hat, written and illustrated by Dr. Seuss, or as you all know, that's the pseudonym for Theodore Geisel, published in 1957. Believe it or not, this book is a book of learning. Who would know? Probably if there are teachers or those who are academics in the room, you would know this. But this book is first and foremost a book of learning, not just a clever rhyming illustrated book. The Cat in the Hat was written at the invitation of William Ellsworth Spaulding, who at the time was the director of the Houghton Mifflin's education division. He gave to his good friend, Dr. Seuss, a list of 225 essential words for first grade readers. And he said to Dr. Seuss, "I challenge you to create a book with these words that children can't put down." So, writing in his traditional anapestic meter, Dr. Seuss actually wrote this book, and he got all but two of the words in. He got 223 of the words in. However, he got in 13 additional age-appropriate words. So in his mind, he more than met the task. So The Cat in the Hat is what's known as a leveled reader. It's also probably the defining book of Dr. Seuss's very long and very successful career. So I continue my walk in the exhibition hall, and I come to the case of nursery rhymes. Short verses customarily told to children or sung to them as lullabies. An ancient oral tradition, nursery rhymes trace the origins, their origins to popular ballads and songs for adults. In the West, the greatest number of nursery rhymes was written during the 16th through the 18th century. Seen in this case before me are a number of wonderful nursery rhymes. First and foremost, we get to see Tommy Thumb's Pretty Songbook, Volume 2. Such an important book. So little. This big. It's often attributed to the English bookseller Mary Cooper, but we don't actually know for sure who wrote it. It was published in 1744. This volume, this very volume, is one of only two surviving copies in the world, and it is the earliest known collection of English nursery rhymes. This is such an important book that the Coatsen Children's Library at Princeton has just done a facsimile of this very book. It's a really important book. It includes such iconic rhymes as Sing a Song of Sixpence, Mary, Mary, Quite Contrary, Baba, Black Sheep, and Hickory Dickory Dock, which I love. In this book, that nursery rhyme is actually titled The Mouse Ran Up Ye Clock. This collection of nursery rhymes is really a seminal work in the history of children's literature, and as I mentioned, it's on loan from the Coatsen Children's Library at Princeton. It's an absolute treasure. Old Mother Hubbard, written by Sarah Catherine Martin, published in 1805. This was traditionally a well-known short rhyme that was very well-known in England. But it was expanded by Martin to a full 14 stanzas and illustrated from her own sketches. This particular version of Old Mother Hubbard, who went to the cupboard to get her poor dog a bone, was an instant bestseller, immediately. It was translated right away into Dutch and German. It has remained popular throughout the English-speaking world to this day. I remember reading it to my son, who is now 31 years old. This volume is on loan from UCLA from Special Collections. The House That Jack Built, illustrated by the famous artist Randolph Caldecott. It was published in 1878. This is the first of 16 popular picture books for children that were illustrated by Caldecott, who is the English artist for whom the Caldecott Medal is named, which is given each year for the most distinguished American picture book. This House That Jack Built is what's called a cumulative nursery rhyme. It's about the dog that worried the cat, that killed the rat, that ate the malt, that lay in the house that Jack built. So, it is important because Caldecott's illustration style was highly action-oriented, which was a great departure from what had come just before him. His style of illustration was new and even revolutionary at his time, which is hard for us to believe. But that's part of why this book is so important. This volume is on loan from the late Pamela Harrer and her husband Ben Harrer. Also in this same case with nursery rhymes are works of poetry. Poetic verse for children has a very long history. Its origins can be traced to the lengthy oral epics for adults, retold more concisely for young audiences. Our poetry for children today, in the 21st and even in the 20th century, children focus much more now on repetition of sounds and phrases, and so there's been a change over time in the kind of poetry we see for children in that way. Three of the important books of poetry for children displayed before me in this case are Songs of Innocence, a real favorite in our household, written and illustrated, of course, by William Blake, starting in 1789. Each of Blake's fewer than 40 copies of Songs of Innocence was hand-printed, hand-bound, and sold by Blake and his wife, Catherine, with almost all known copies hand-colored and hand-illuminated by them. Absolutely magnificent book. It includes many beloved poems. One in particular, The Lamb, is quite famous. Its well-known first lines are, "Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee?" The poems in this book show that for Blake, childhood symbolized an ideal and a unified condition for the human soul, and that sadly that changed with the arrival of adulthood. Many of you know Blake was a visionary author, artist, printer. He's recognized today as a cultural icon across the English-speaking world. This truly magnificent copy, I can't tell you how beautiful this book is on loan from the Morgan Library in New York City. A Visit from St. Nicholas, written by Clement Moore and illustrated by Thomas Nast, was published circa 1870. We know this best, most of us, I think, as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, the first line of this poem. And this poem first appeared in a newspaper in 1823. It took many years, not until 1862, for this poem to be printed in a book. 8 years after that, this particular edition, published by McLaughlin Brothers, this chromolithographic edition, was illustrated by the popular political cartoonist Thomas Nast. He was very well known at the time. This book is so important because, for many reasons, but in particular, it was Nast who famously gave us the picture of Santa with his white beard, his red suit, his jolly elf form that we take for granted today. But that's where we get our vision of Santa Claus. The poem became one of the most widely printed, imitated, and parodied sets of verses in the United States. This particular copy is on loan from the Beinecke Library at Yale. Madeline, one of my favorites. Written and illustrated by Ludwig Bemelmans, published in 1939. Bemelmans was, as many of you know, a prolific author and illustrator. But this Caldecott Honor Book is the most famous of his seven rhyming picture books about a little French girl called Madeline. Each of the seven books begins with this verse. In an old house in Paris that was covered with vines lived 12 little girls in two straight lines. They left the house at 9:30. The smallest one was Madeline. I love to hear how many people not only know that but can say it. That's exactly right. Continuously in print, this wonderful picture book has inspired numerous toys, games, and dolls. And each doll of Madeline has an embroidered scar on it, recalling Madeline's appendectomy in this book. This copy is on loan from Ellen Michelson. All right, I'm continuing my walk now in the exhibition hall, and I come to the case focusing on books for girls and boys. It's centered on their experiences with family and their experiences facing challenges in their lives. That's the theme that unites all of these books. These kinds of experiences have been constant for girls and boys across the ages, and that's certainly the case in the three volumes that are in front of me from the 19th and the 20th centuries. The first of those is Anne of Green Gables, written by Lucy Maud Montgomery, published in 1908. This is Canada's beloved children's book about the young orphan, Anne Shirley, who's sent to live on a very remote farm called Green Gables on Prince Edward Island, which is off the eastern coast of Canada. Montgomery recorded her original idea for this book in her diary, when she wrote, quote, "Elderly couple apply to orphan asylum for boy. By mistake, girl is sent," unquote. Initially rejected right and left by publishers, Anne of Green Gables went on to become a huge literary success. Huge. Bringing lifelong distinction to Montgomery and extensive literary tourism to Prince Edward Island, which is still the mainstay of the island's economy today. Truly. This pristine copy, I believe this is the most beautiful copy of this book I have ever seen. You never see this book clean. This gorgeous copy is on loan from collector Stuart Rose. Eloise, another fun book, written by Kay Thompson, which is the pseudonym for Catherine Fink. illustrated by Hilary Knight and published in 1955. Author Kay Thompson was a singer, a composer, an actress, and she was the godmother of Liza Minnelli, who is often cited as the inspiration for the character of Eloise. This is a very entertaining picture book, as many of you know, about a rowdy 6-year-old girl living in the Plaza Hotel in New York City. It was an immediate and an enduring success, immediate success. Because of this book, the Plaza Hotel was designated a literary landmark, and Eloise's portrait, which was painted by illustrator Hilary Knight, still hangs in the Palm Court at the Plaza Hotel. This copy is on loan from Ellen Michelson. And The Snowy Day, not a book that everyone knows, but a very important book, written and illustrated by Ezra Jack Keats, published in 1962. This is a really charming and simple book. It's a story about Peter, a young boy who's happily playing in his neighborhood on the first day of snow. It's a book that has an important place in our country's history. Peter is a child of color, and he was a breakthrough character in a time of heightened racial tensions in 1960s America. Peter is thought to be the first depiction of an African-American child on the cover of a major U.S. publication for children. This book was published by Viking Press. The story won Keats the Caldecott Medal, and he went on to write 6 additional books about Peter, whose statue stands today in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, which is the neighborhood that the author grew up in, which is now a very snazzy neighborhood, and at the time it was not. This copy is on loan from Ellen Michelson. Okay, we've arrived now at one of my favorite display cases, the one showing children's books with characters that are animals. Starting centuries ago with Aesop's Fables, as we saw earlier, authors have often imbued animals with human sentiments and given them the ability to walk upright and to talk out loud. Anthropomorphized animals are a time-honored method of conveying literary truths to children to allow them to learn more easily and to better retain the memory of a story. There are key animal characters in the following 3 children's books in front of me. First and foremost, The Tale of Peter Rabbit, written and illustrated by Beatrix Potter, privately printed by her in 1901. Originally a hand-illustrated letter to a child, that's where it came from. Potter's manuscript and drawings for Peter Rabbit were circulated unsuccessfully to 7 publishers in England. She could not get this book published to save her life, as many of you know. She eventually self-published 250 copies, with a second immediate reprinting the year after. the thing that's important besides the fame of this book is the frontispiece, which you see here, the color frontispiece. It itself is of historical interest because it's one of the earliest examples of, at the time, the new 3-color printing process used in a printed book. So it was a unique thing that she accomplished in putting this book together. This copy was a gift from Beatrix Potter to her cousin, so it has wonderful provenance. It's on loan again from Ellen Michelson. Good Night Moon, written by Margaret Wise Brown, illustrated by Clement Hurd, published in 1947. Brown was a teacher and a very prolific children's book author. She was associated with the Bank Street School of Education in New York City. In this very famous book of hers, she portrays a young rabbit saying goodnight to the many objects in his or her bedroom. The soothing, repetitive verses, as well as the progressively dimming light in each illustration, subtly encourages slumber for the child who's reading or listening to this particular book. It was an international success. It inspired film, television, theatrical, and musical adaptations, and it inspired many parodies as well. The most recently, a book that some of you may have heard of called Goodnight iPad, written by David Milgram. He wrote Goodnight iPad under the humorous pseudonym Android, which I thought was very cute. This book is on loan from Ellen Michelson as well. Charlotte's Web, written by E.B. White, illustrated by Garth Williams, published in 1952. This is one of the best-selling American children's books of all time. It's the story of Wilbur the Pig, destined to become bacon by Christmas, and Charlotte, a sympathetic and well-educated spider. This beloved New England barnyard story of how Charlotte spins messages in her spider web to help save Wilbur has touched the hearts of millions and millions of young readers, and it's brought a gentle understanding of Charlotte's demise as a part of the natural course of things. Translated into over 20 different languages, this copy is also on loan from Ellen Michelson. Okay, I've come now to one of the final display cases showing fantasy books for children. Fantasy literature involves imaginary stories that reshape or depart from reality. Fantasy is essential in the lives of children as a vital part of their play. As a result, it offers a really rich opportunity for children's for childhood development. It's fantasy is found throughout all of children's literature. Some of the most famous books of fantasy in this case are Gulliver's Travels, written by Jonathan Swift, published in 1726, very, very early. This first edition of Gulliver's Travels was highly successful, with revised, abridged, and translated editions following in the hundreds. It brought the terms Lilliputians, Brobdingnagians, and Yahoos into the English language. This story was not originally written for children, as you may know, but Gulliver's many adventures as a giant and as a child-sized toy, if you will, appealed hugely to young readers from the very beginning. As such, it's one of the three books in this exhibition that was originally written for adults, but included because it was immediately appropriated by children. We just felt we could not leave this book out. This adult first edition is on loan from the Lilly Library at Indiana University. And I'm going to show you now a later juvenile edition of Gulliver's Travels, same book published in 1772. We've done this in each case. Whenever we've had a book that's for adults, we've paired it with a juvenile edition. This is an early abridgment of the book. It's bound, as you can see, in Dutch floral paper boards, a very important early tradition in children's literature, Dutch paper. It was issued by John Newbery's nephew, Francis, demonstrating that publishers clearly recognized the demand for children's editions of this story and many others. The 19th century saw multiple toy book editions of Gulliver's Travels, and the 20th century saw this book illustrated by very important people like Arthur Rackham and William Pugani. This copy is on loan from the Coates and Children's Library at Princeton. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Is there a more iconic book of fantasy? Written by Lewis Carroll, illustrated by John Tenniel, and published this first edition in 1865. This is an unprecedented book in terms of the breadth of its fantasy, wordplay, nonsense verse, and mathematical puzzling. Alice and her many adventures invite interpretations on lots of levels, engaging children and scholars for generations, ever since it's been published. This copy of the withdrawn first edition of 1865, with 10 signed pencil drawings by Tenniel bound into this copy, was also marked up by Lewis Carroll in his trademark purple ink in preparation for the Nursery Alice, his abridgment for younger children. This book has been translated into more than 150 languages. Unbelievable. Alice is one of the most iconic books of fantasy ever written. This fabulous version of Alice is on loan from a private library. Where the Wild Things Are, written and illustrated by the very well-known Maurice Sendak, published in 1963. This was a groundbreaking picture book at its time. It creates the vivid fantasy world of Max, the rambunctious boy sent to bed without supper, who imagines a journey to a faraway island inhabited by ferocious wild things. This book was first hinted at in 1955 in Sendak's elongated strip manuscript, almost like a cartoon manuscript, if you will, called Where the Wild Horses Are. That's where this book started, with horses. Some of the influences that shaped Sendak's development of wild things characters away from horses to wild things were King Kong and his own memories of, as he has said, his overpowering Jewish relations coming to Sunday dinner each week. And if you talk with Maurice Sendak, if you did talk with him in the past, he would be able to tell you the names of his relatives and point out exactly which wild thing they became, which I thought was very cute. this book has had extraordinary emotional impact for readers from the very beginning, and Sendak has achieved that with a mere 338 words. There are only 10 sentences in this book. That is hard to do, if you ask me. So these very few number of words, coupled with his very dramatic illustrations, were really groundbreaking at the time. Again, it's hard for us to appreciate that now, but it was very groundbreaking. Found today in over a dozen translations, the story has been retold as an opera with sets and costumes that Sendak designed. It's been a Hollywood feature film as well by Spike Lee. Sendak's New York Times obituary described him as widely considered to be the most important children's book artist of the 20th century. This book is on loan from Ellen Michelson. So I've come now to the end of this Grow Your Children's Book exhibition, and I'm standing facing this wonderful watercolor. It's painted by Walter Crane, who was a famous 19th century British artist of children's books, an illustrator of other things as well. This watercolor recalls, for me, the structure and beauty of a medieval illuminated manuscript, only one for children. This one populated with vivid scenes from 9 different nursery rhymes, such as Hi Diddle Diddle, Little Boy Blue, and 3 Blind Mice. This work of art has been truly my inspiration for the Grow Your 100 children's book exhibition from the very beginning. It symbolizes my belief that literature for children is forged from the same enduring elements as literature for adults: powerful narrative, unforgettable characters, illustration that stirs the imagination, and insights that engage the mind and heart. As I turn now, finally, to leave the exhibition hall, I hope that visitors to the exhibition and those who read the catalog will see that literature for children truly does stand tall on the shelf with literature for adults. Thank you.